Like Sue said, my name is Lori Fazzino. I'm a doctoral student and a graduate instructor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas in the Department of Sociology. What I'm going to be talking to you about today is it emerged from my master's research that I did last year. Now, I looked at the process of deconversion, you know, leaving religion, but I focused specifically on leaving evangelical Christianity. So it's weird for me to be here in front of you speaking because I didn't talk to anybody that left Mormonism. But there are a lot of parallels that we're going to discuss today, and maybe the experience of my participants will actually resonate with some of you. So the aims of my talk today is to share the experience of deconversion. I'm going to warn you now. I'm going to be sharing parts of interviews from my participants. In some of those narratives, there's a little bit of delicate language. Okay, so I'm just warning you now. I don't like to censor them. You know, I don't like to censor these if I don't have to, because, you know, what they say and the language that they use to talk about their experiences really conveys an emotion. So do not say I did not warn you. The experiences of deconversion oftentimes are, you know, met with rejection, loneliness, alienation, you know, stigmatization. But today we're going to address our crucial role, and we all have a role if we know somebody that's leaving religion. I'm going to address our role in easing that transition from belief to non-belief, as well as creating a happy and satisfying secular experience. Because a secular experience, an identity of a non-believer can be happy and liberating and freeing and satisfying. It's no longer stigmatized and lonely like it used to be. Any good researcher must acknowledge where their role is in the research. Researchers are never absent from their research. And so I want to talk a little bit about myself, let you get to know me a little bit, and kind of talk about how I came to do this project. Now, I was raised Catholic, right? In the beginning, with Catholic, yeah, there's pictures. Being Catholic, I had no connection to the divine. Right? It was very formulaic. It was like, sit, stand, kneel, sit, stand, kneel. I don't know if any of you ever been to a Catholic mass. Okay, sit, stand, kneel. That's what it is. There was just no connection. There was no social connection either. Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's fine. Look at the PowerPoint, don't look at me. There was no social connection. I wasn't, and I was young, but my parents had no connection in the Catholic Church either. It was very isolating, and all we did was sit, stand, and kneel. So why study deconversion? Well, when I was in the Catholic Church, when I decided to leave, you know, I figured there's got to be something more, right? There's got to be something more than opening a missal book and saying a prayer, reciting a prayer. If there's a God and this world is so wondrous, there's got to be something more than that. And I knew I wasn't going to find it in Catholic Church. And so when I was about 15, I left. When I was 16, I got saved. I got saved at something called the Nerd Ball. It was a New Year's Eve party for teenagers, you know, one that no drinking, no drugs. We were in a church, and it was lots of fun. And, you know, the pastor gave the altar call, and, you know, if your heart is beating really fast and your arm weighs 1,000 pounds, then that's God talking to your heart. And that was me, so I guess God was talking to my heart. Yes, finally, I had a connection to the divine. So I got saved. I got saved, and then I promptly founded a Christian club in my high school. That was not met with joy from administrators, believe it or not. This was in Washington, so, you know, they're pretty secular up there. But after graduation, I kind of floundered around for a couple years. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't go straight to college, and I was just kind of doing whatever, you know, just traveling, doing whatever. But at some point, I decided I was going to go to Christian college because my friends were there. And instead of doing that, I became a youth intern in the youth ministry at a big mega church in Seattle, Washington, called Christian Faith Center. I don't know if you recognize Casey; he's on the TV like all the time. Mega church, very rock concert and very cutting edge, very pop culture. So it was fun. It was a really great place to be, and I felt like I was home. My life at Christian Faith Center was interesting. There were many dogmatic expectations that I didn't experience in Catholic Church. For example, in the internship, boys and girls could not be alone together, not in an office, not in a house, not in a car. We always had to be very modest. Now, you know, I didn't have quite as many tattoos then as I do now. But I can't tell you the number of times I was sent home because I didn't look the part and I had to change my clothes. Big push on accountability. Okay, if you've ever seen that South Park with Butters, right, when he's going to the Pray the Gay Away camp and he's got the accountability buddy. Yeah, it was all about that. I had an accountability buddy who ended up being my gay boyfriend. True story. And there was a large focus about spending time in the Word. Is that the Word? Is that part of Mormonism? I'm not sure. But yeah, the Word, the Bible. Read the Bible always. Pray and read the Bible. But I was a little crazy then. I was about 20 years old. I didn't really adhere to many Christian standards. And I went through a brief goth phase. This was me welcoming teenagers to youth group as a goth. So suffice to say, I had some issues in the church. But what the church was really great at and what I missed and what's going to be at the crux of our talk today is the social connection, right? Halfway through my time at Christian Faith Center, my youth pastor felt the call from God, right? God knocked, he answered, or God called, he answered, and he was told to start a church. And so we left. We left and we went to his basement, and we rented a junior high school, and we started a church, real-life church. And at real-life church, it was all about the young people. It was all about the interns. It was all about social connection. That's the pastor right there, back in his younger days. It was all about doing all this fun stuff and having all this connection, but doing it for God. And you know what? That felt really good. It felt good to be connected. It felt good to have people, you know, that had my back or that, you know, I could be prayer warriors with. You know, when Sue was talking about spiritual warfare earlier this morning, oh yeah, I was a prayer spiritual warrior. Not anymore, but I was. I was quite good at it too. After my internship, I had some new opportunities, which ended up turning to be new failures. I was offered a position to be an intern director in Astoria, Oregon. But I had no authority. Like, I had people that I was in charge of, but I wasn't allowed to tell them anything. Right? Okay, right? Because I thought it was just me. Thank you. Thank you for the validation. Right? The youth pastor I worked under actually was our children's pastor at Christian Faith Center, and unbeknownst to me, he had quite the anger management issue. And I also had different dogmatic and gender expectations. So the senior pastor was a little nuts, and I mean that in the best way possible. I do. This was the year 2000, and you know, he gave a sermon as to why Jesus was coming back in 2000. I don't know if he's still waiting there. Jesus didn't come. But I remember him walking in one day saying, "Lori, do you know any fine young men that want to be ordained as a pastor?" And I was there reading my Bible, spending time in the Word. And I said, "Well, Pastor Dave, I was hoping you'd ordain me." And he was like, "Do you want to be the husband of one good wife?" Do I want to be the husband of one good wife? Wait a second. Well, in 1 Timothy, and I'm like, but this is a different time. Suffice to say, he was never going to ordain me because I have a vagina. I also had unmet personal expectations there. I really wanted to get married. I really wanted to be loved. Astoria, Oregon, not exactly, you know, a great place for finding a mate. This led to me just being very disappointed and backsliding. You know what happens when you backslide, right? You know where you're going. You know where you're going. Or at least that's what they tell you. So you'd think life on the outside would be better, but it wasn't. And I'm going to get personal here with you. Okay? On the outside, I felt lost. I felt rejected. And I dealt with some negative life experiences. I lost all my friends, got pregnant, and had a kid with a man who liked to hit me. Right? Not making good choices. I finally hit rock bottom when I decided I was going to leave him, and my daughter and I were homeless for a short period of time. And what else could I do but turn back to the church that I left from? The prodigal daughter returned. When I returned, I had a spoiled identity, though. That's a sociological term. People perceived me very differently. Okay? I got into a single mom transitional housing program called Vine Maple Place, and all of a sudden, because I did well, I became the poster child. Even after I moved out and got married, I was still the poster child for this, so it never changed. Okay, I had this label of a deviant status, right? Because I was the girl who left and got knocked up, and I had to come back, and they had to save me. Now, I did try to unspoil my identity by getting married, right? It was quite beautiful. It was lovely. To a man that was totally wrong for me. Okay, not a good idea. Still making bad choices. And I got back together with a great social circle. Didn't last. Turns out I don't make a very good evangelical Christian. Who knew? Right? So in 2006... I was going, starting the process of going through a divorce, dealing with some other personal issues that arose, and I became kicked out of my church, as excommunicated from an evangelical church as you can be. I do believe what my old pastor told the husband was, if she comes back here again, I'm going to call the police. Handcuffs. Fancy. Suffice to say, I did not go back. But this led me to, years later, this led me to thinking about deconversion. Like, I wondered if other people's experiences were like mine. My leaving the church, my ceasing the participation, occurred long before my belief stopped. Right? Because my problems were social. They were of a social nature. And that, for me, didn't negate the existence of God, all right? I just thought that God had some crappy people, right? Maybe it'd be built elsewhere, but it really never was, and I lost all of my friends. Literally, pastor called and said, do not help her, which is not the very Christian thing to do, right? You help people that are in need. So eventually, I stopped believing as well. Years later, I wanted to learn more about this process for other people. So let's characterize deconversion, shall we? Barber, who's a scholar of deconversion, identifies four distinguishing characteristics present in most deconversions. These include intellectual doubt, moral criticisms, emotional suffering, and then finally, disaffiliation from the community. When you disaffiliate, there are four primary ideological deconversion trajectories. You can denomination switch, right? Jumping from one, like, I'm an evangelical Christian, now I'm Mormon. It doesn't work like that, right? I can't, no? Okay. I can become spiritual but not religious, right? I don't go to church, I don't believe in organized religion, but I go hiking, and that's where I find my God. I can be an agnostic, which is where I currently lean. I'm more atheism. Now, there's lots of subcategories. So I said these are four primary, right? You can be a secularist and humanist, and even atheists have so many different categories, right? This is just kind of an ideological trajectory, if you will. What's the connection to Mormonism? This used to be at the end of the presentation, but I thought I'd bump it on up for you guys. You all seem like a good group. Okay. Now, I got to tell you, I'm really, really shocked. Even today, I went to the literature, because that's what I do, I'm a scholar, and I looked for some recent studies on Mormon deconversion, Mormon disaffiliation. You know what I found? Zero. What's up with that? Right? So this is what I have, okay? Now, when I gave this talk to the group in St. George, some of them got mad at some of the stuff that I'm about to say. Listen, I'm the messenger. I'm not the researcher. Okay, don't get mad at me. I'm saying this is what they said. And just take note of the years, because it's very outdated. So who is the Mormon deconvert? Okay, in 1989, okay, that's quite a while ago, the findings said that Mormons who deconvert are mostly between the ages of 30 and 39. They're married, but they're in their first marriage. Is multiple marriages common? Yeah? Yeah. Oh, yes. She said yes. Oh, we should talk later. Their religious preference was just a straight none. And interestingly, they were still on the LDS membership role. The role. Is it hard to get off of there?
It's easy.
Never, never. Once a member, always a member. And even after you die, right? That happens too? Yeah? Okay, but why do they leave? Okay, so this is not, you know, this is not too far off, you know, I don't think. Reasons for disaffiliation is conflicts over lifestyle and beliefs. Can we all say duh? Right? Family needs, right? So maybe you're married to somebody that wasn't Mormon, and, you know, you put your marriage first, so you leave. And unmet personal and spiritual needs, right? We know what that's like. I think almost everybody in this room probably knows what that's like. Now, here's where you're probably going to get a little upset. Okay, so what are the parallels between Mormonism and evangelical deconversion? Okay, so in 1969, that's even older, right? The dimensions of disaffection were intellectual reasons, so a disbelief in the central tenets of Mormonism. I can buy that. It was emotional, reaction against attitudinal or behavioral inconsistencies. So kind of like, you know, I had my social problems, right? Kind of the same thing. And social, unsatisfying social experiences, formation of secular social bonds. So the emotional and the social kind of, I think, are kind of tied. What this study found is that these deconverts had a greater propensity to abandon all religions. And here's why. This is what they say. Okay, to reduce stigma, so do not denomination switch, because that's just going to create more stigma. Apostasy doesn't change denominational negation, right? So if you're a Mormon and you think evangelical Christianity is just a bunch of bull and you leave Mormonism, well, that doesn't mean that evangelical Christianity is still not just a bunch of bull, right? So you're not affiliating with anything. But this is what people got upset about, right? That most disaffiliates were never firm believers in the first place, right? Wrong, right? I don't know what's going on here. So there's some limitations with these studies besides the fact that they are old, right? Studies like this are done quantitatively, meaning that you're filling out a survey, you never see the researcher, you know, you're just another, you know, ID number, okay? Think about your experiences. Think about your own leaving the church experiences. Now try and quantify those experiences by checking a box. Can you do that? No. Right? So these studies are limited because nobody's actually talking to ex or post-Mormons. Why? What happened that made you leave? Like, what went down? You know, just check a box. To me, that's not sufficient. And so when I approached my study of deconversion, I wanted to talk to people. I wanted to get their stories. I wanted to get down and dirty and figure out what was going on. I didn't care about your age range, right? I don't want you to check a box. I simply found my participants and I said, tell me your story. Throughout all my research, I interviewed about 20 people. What I'm presenting you today are just the atheist participants, and here's why. Atheists, in case you didn't know, are just about the most stigmatized group of people in the United States. December of 2011, a trust study came out of the University of British Columbia, and they found that there was only one group of people that were trusted less than atheists. Anybody want to guess?
Mormons.
Rapists. Rapists, right? Rapists, atheists. You don't want to be with me in a dark alley. That's all I'm saying. right? I wanted to present, because they're so stigmatized, I wanted to present their narratives. I wanted you to get to know them the way that I got to know them. I wanted you to hear their stories and see if it resonated with your own. So deconversion, right, is a gradual process. Okay, it's not even just one process. It's multidimensional, and it exists on a continuum. You've got a lot happening up in the front. Okay, you've got a lot happening before you actually make that decision. I'm never going back, and I'm totally not believing in this crap anymore. Okay, and then that's actually instantaneous. That's what I found. At that moment, when that decision was made, that decision was done. But then you have a whole bunch of stuff going on in the bottom, right, after. What is life after? So this is multidimensional, and it's a long process. What I found up front was that my participants experienced what I'm calling a typology of experience. They had cognitive experiences, right, where it was comprised of logical inconsistencies and dogma rejection, right? Something just doesn't make sense. There were social experiences. This isn't too different than, you know, the dimensions of deconversion, right? This primarily focused on behavioral inconsistencies within religious community. Say it with me, hypocrisy. Now, these cognitive and social experiences created emotional experiences. These are shaped by the cognitive and the social, and they contribute to moral dissonance and internal conflict. All right? Have you ever just been torn about something? That sucks. Okay, that just nobody wants that. But this is what a lot of my participants faced. So I want to address the cognitive experience, because it was really interesting. There was a difference between my atheist participants and then those that identified as agnostic or spiritual, not religious. The atheist participants, they had some social experiences, and I'm going to share those with you. But their experiences were primarily cognitive. All right, I'm a sociologist, so I'm not really allowed to say this, but I'm gonna anyway, so long as you don't tell my advisory committee. It was almost as if people who identified as atheists had this natural propensity to just toward logic and rational thought. Like, their brain just didn't work in a way that was conducive to religion or faith. That's my position, I'm sticking to it, all right? Don't tell my chair, okay? Cognitive experiences. This is George, a 29-year-old hospitality manager. This is what he says. He says he, the pastor, would preach about the earth being 10,000 years old. Everything we know about science, everything we know about geology and the formation of the earth completely contradicted everything I was hearing in church. You think? Okay. Earth is 10,000 years old. Earth is 4.6 billion years old. Okay, we have carbon dating here, and we're just going to go by what this book says. Okay, what's going on? Like, I don't know what to think, right? This is a lot of what was happening for them. Kimberly, 18-year-old college freshman, who at the time of this interview was not out as an atheist, and I think she is now, good for her. But she says, I started learning some basic psychology of why we believe certain things, and I found that my beliefs weren't supported by much. Good for her, okay? Because a lot of the literature on unconventional belief systems will say that people, when they're faced with this, la, 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 they just don't hear it, right? They just want to keep their beliefs because it's safe, right? We can agree to that. It's safe. It's comfortable. It's like that warm, fuzzy, snuggy, right? That's what my religious belief is. But she said, nah, there's something going on here. The result of cognitive experiences leads to the development of intellectual doubt. Okay? The atheists were like, this does not make sense. I cannot wrap my mind around this paradigm. Okay? It just can't get there logically, rationally. It just doesn't work. And we'll see, not for lack of trying. Okay? Adam, who you're going to love. You're going to love Adam. Adam began rejecting various parts of theological doctrine. That I did not finish that sentence. Look at that. Love that. I was typing that before I came down. Let me tell you a little bit about Adam. Adam, when he was 16 years old, self-described as an on-fire Christian, evangelical, he worked a job. And you know what he did with his money? He sent his friends to Bible camp. Okay, how many of you, by show of hands? Okay, we're 16 years old working to send your friends to Bible camp. Anybody? Any takers? No? Yeah, right, me neither. Okay, I was working at McDonald's and I was buying clothes. Okay, so he was on fire. He was on the pastoral track. But then, as he got older, some things just didn't work. Some things just didn't logically make sense, right? He couldn't reconcile the idea of an all-just, all-loving God with hell, you know, or with hating gays. Like, it just doesn't. It's just not. It's not logically sound, right? So for him, he just started saying, you know, I started cherry-picking. I don't need that part of doctrine. I'm just going to kick that aside. He eventually deconverted, as we'll see. Obviously, he's here. Okay. Many of my participants sought information from other religious texts. Okay, so maybe my belief isn't, you know, working out, but maybe something else just, you know, makes more sense. For example, Elizabeth, who was a 27-year-old entrepreneur, said that she began reading the Quran, the Satanic Bible, Kabbalic works, the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, she really committed. Then I started reading the Gnostic Gospels. You can't really read church history and not see how political and manipulated it was. Word, sister. Okay. This is consistent with a lot of the literature that says the more educated you are and the more you read, and especially if you read the Bible like cover to cover, you're out. You're bouncing. Like, it's just not working. Right? Does anybody, I mean, do you guys understand? Yeah? Okay, good. Yay, parallels, I love it. Can I get an amen? No, like I said, they did have social experiences. This was not the primary experience, but, you know, it was still there because hypocrisy doesn't really go away. So Elizabeth, whose father was a pastor, and he was one of those I'm going to call you out from the pulpit kind of pastors, okay? Yeah, right? And her mom worked in ministry as well. You know, just because you work in the ministry doesn't mean that you were on 24/7. So when they're at home, they, you know, were doing what we all do, inventing and talking and, you know, things of that nature. Elizabeth says, "My parents spoke very openly about things they would criticize. I definitely grew up seeing hypocrisy. It wasn't really hidden from me. I definitely started picking up on those themes at an early age." Socialization. Kimberly was talking about this girl in youth group, this, like, you know, kind of like one of those all-American cheerleadery type ideal girls, like, good Christian, like, yay, good Christian girl. It was a mask, it was an act. About this girl, Kimberly says, she always talked about being nice to people, but then I would see hypocrisy. I would see her completely shutting people down. Okay? You can know a lot about a person by their actions, not necessarily their words. And these were the social experiences, repeated experiences of hypocrisy. Now, for the agnostics and the spiritual, not religious, this was their primary experience. So, like, this was my primary experience. I thought it was interesting, the different primary experiences and the different self-identities post-deconversion. I'm going to do more with that in years to come. Stay tuned. The result of social experiences was the experience of the development of spiritual doubt, right? So there was definitely a questioning about authenticity, right? When you see people saying, "I love the Lord, hallelujah," bitch, you know, like, how authentic are you? And that really caused a stumbling block for many of these participants. Now, like I said, the cognitive and the social created emotional experiences. I want to introduce you to my participant, whose name is Barclay. Barclay is actually a very good friend of mine. And he became a good friend after this. I'll give you a little background about Barclay. Barclay was a straight-A student, played trumpet. Bill Trumpet is what he plays. Trumpet, let's just go with that. Won a Grammy, actually, for some ensemble thing when he was in high school. Smart guy, nice guy. Was always trying to get his friends saved because that's what his mom said he had to do. And as smart and as nice and as talented as he was, his brother was always better. He was always compared to his brother by his parents. So no matter what A he got in what subject, you know, what award he got, what honor he got, was never good enough. So he found solace in church. He found acceptance in church. You know, his brother didn't go to church, so he wasn't being compared. He could just be him, right? What an amazing feeling. It can just be me. He went to a performing arts high school where they had a really large gay pride alliance. And his plan, even though in church he was going out and feeding the homeless, on a Saturday and on Sunday he was being taught to hate gays and homosexuals, right? His plan was to become president of this pride alliance and then shut the whole thing down. It was his plan. I know, right? Nice guy. He really is a nice guy. But something happened. This is what he says. He says, I went to a performing arts high school with a very large gay population. Around the end of my freshman year, my best friend told me he was gay. Uh-oh. So I asked him, like, what was that? What was that like for you? You're supposed to hate homosexuals, right? This is your best friend. And he says that it was this weird shift of I should hate this person, but I can't. Imagine that. He's not a bad person. He's not immoral. He's a normal human being, better than half the Christians I know. Right? So, right there, you can start to see how there's a logical cognitive problem happening. Wait, I was taught that all homosexuals are immoral. Okay, they're all going to burn in hell, but this is my best friend, and he's a really great guy. Delicate language. Bark. I said, so, okay, what did you do? What did you do? And he says, I was so mentally fucked at the time. I was most concerned with my well-being and base morality. I have a moral gay best friend. One of these things isn't right. Okay? So, aside from the cognitive, logical, you know, experiences that are happening, now there's some social hypocrisy going on, right? And got to thinking, feeding the homeless, but I'm hating homosexuals? Something's not right. Moment of deconversion. Barclay says, I always saw the Christian community as hypocritical, preaching morals and expounding their virtuous lifestyles while living in the squalor of filth and self-deprivation. It started weighing on me of what it is to be moral. Who decides morality? And then I actually went back and read the Bible cover to cover. I was appalled at most of the moral teachings. This is clearly no way to live a moral lifestyle. Remember how I told you that Barclay found acceptance and self-esteem and self-worth in church? It's a lot to lose, right? He did it right then and there. Right then and there. Done. It's a lot to give up. Adam, my Bible camp, sending people to working, mowing the lawn guy, from Washington, got married, young love, bought a restaurant. Her family was very religious. So he had confronted atheists before. He played poker online when I guess that was still legal. Confronted atheists before. He had teachers even challenge him. What makes you think your religion is so special? You think if you were born in, like, Iran, your religion would be that great? Like, you're going to the good place? And he never saw this as a challenge. This was never a challenge to his faith. Okay? If anything, it just motivated him to go to, you know, find out how to better construct his argument. So he would read stuff from atheists. Right? He would read Christian apologetics. He would read anything he could get his hands on just so he could debate. So this really wasn't an issue for him. Him and his wife and his wife's family were taking a trip to Mexico. Lucky. Right? And before he leaves, he picks up Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion book. Okay? You guys know where I'm going, don't you? Okay, packs it away. Okay, goes to Mexico. It's a fantastic time. On the last day, he's the leader of the Bible study because all the males led Bible study. So if you had a vagina and you went on the trip, you didn't get to lead a Bible study. Very gendered. Now this is what Adam says, because he eventually does get to the book. He says, "So on the plane ride home from Mexico, I was reading." So he's reading the God Delusion. "I had a moment where I was reading through one of the arguments that he made in the book, and I'm reading through, I was like, okay, I accept your premise, okay, go. I follow step by step with the arguments, and it gets to the end, and it was a correct argument. I accept the premise, I accept the arguments, I have no choice but to accept the conclusion, and I am like, fuck." Because I didn't expect that. I didn't know what that meant. My wife is sitting next to me with her head on my shoulder asleep, and 18 hours ago I was leading a Bible study, and now I just read this thing that said God doesn't exist, and I believe it. Adam's currently in law school, by the way. See, he follows the arguments, man. Right? Wow. Wow. His evangelical Christian wife. Right? They're on the plane. Family vacation. Okay? What does this mean? Instant moment. Now, like I said, his world wasn't rocked. I mean, he was challenged, but he didn't see it as a threat to his faith. And bam. Instantaneous moment. Let's get to Elizabeth. Now, like I said, for some of the participants, they couldn't just get there cognitively, rationally, but it wasn't for lack of trying. It wasn't because they didn't want to, okay? Elizabeth says, "It literally was one day I identified as Christian and the next day I didn't. Christian one day and not the next. I just felt like I wanted so much to believe. I really did, really wanted to believe. Whether it was to make my parents happy or because I thought it was the right thing, I wanted desperately to believe." I have another quote from Elizabeth that I want to share. Okay, so kind of a big one, so just go with me. Okay. This was her emotional experience, trying to reconcile whatever was going on. She says, "I just felt like it was going, like I had no more. I was out of giving God chances." Anybody ever been there? Yeah. Right? Okay. "I was done with trying. Done with trying to recommit myself to God and feeling like it was never good enough. Whatever little mistake I would make, I would feel guilty about it forever. So I went up to the prayer room and I just sat up there. I don't know how long, but I was up there for a while. And I just prayed and I cried and I said, I know that I'm not supposed to give you an ultimatum. I know that this is not what we're supposed to do. But I've tried so many times. I said, God, if you are real and you want me to follow you, please, this is the last time I'm going to try this. This is the last chance. I need you to reveal yourself to me. I've never felt your presence, felt the Spirit like everyone else talks about, and I desperately want to. This is your last chance to fill me with the Spirit. I'm not trying after this." Anybody give God an ultimatum ever? Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, me too. Okay, now, let's just say you're God. Each one of you, okay? And your child is on his or her knees, crying, begging, pleading to feel something. And you're God. Your child that you love. You think you might, like, just throw him or her a bone? Give her something to believe in? Never happened for Elizabeth. She went home. This was right before Christmas break. She was at college. She went home. She came back to school. Nothing changed. And then the previous quote, like, Christian one day, not Christian the next. So it wasn't for lack of trying. It wasn't for lack of wanting it. Okay? And just not getting it. Anybody else ever want it and just not get it? Yeah. Yeah. So you know. You know what that's like. So what happens, right? They make this decision. Then what? Right? Participants enter into a state of liminality, so they're no longer religious, no longer Christian, but they are, insert question mark here, like, they don't know. And they experienced immediate crises. So Adam goes home. Like, he waits about 4 days. Then realizes, okay, this is going to stick. Okay? He talks to his wife. Honey, I think I'm an atheist. Right? She looked at him, turned around, and ran out the house. Not a word. Ran to her parents. Came home hours later, says, I want a divorce. He didn't want a divorce. He loved his, you know, God-fearing evangelical wife. He just wanted to figure out what this meant. She stuck around for about 2 months and then divorced him, right? And he didn't want that. But his primary concern was trying to figure out, like, what does this mean? I'm an atheist. What does that mean? I don't believe in God. What does that mean? Elizabeth came out to her family, her God-loving, non-judgmental, all right, who am I kidding? Her God-loving parents, who swiftly kicked her out on the street. She ended up moving 2,000 miles across the country to go move in with her internet boyfriend. They're married now, though, so it's, you know, they're good. This is probably the saddest for me. Barclay completely lost his sense of self-worth, right? Completely, it's all gone. Well, he decided to escape through alcohol and substance abuse. Now, that's sad. Clearly, there's a lot to lose here, right? And this is consistent across just any denomination, right? The experience of deconversion across denominational boundaries is that deconverts, defectors, they have little resources and few allies. Anybody experience that when you left? Little resources, few allies, right? Who do you turn to? What do? So like I said, they're in this immediate liminal phase, right? They have no kind of identity, you know, religious or non-religious, you know, really at all. If they do take a label like Adam took atheist, they don't know what that means, okay? They had to do some work. So remember, up here, very gradual, right? Typology experience. Instant moments deconversion, right? But then down below, afterwards, comes the work, okay? This is what I found that they had to do. They had to do what I call paradigmatic work, okay? It's the cognitive, the social, the emotional work processes that were necessary for the intentional dismantlement of the dominant worldview, right, the religious worldview, and the adoption of a wholly different worldview, a secular worldview, one of non-belief. Cognitive work really relied on epistemological restructuring, right? Dissonance reduction, so you had to get rid of that conflict inside, right? And biographical reconstruction, okay? Understanding why you might have been religious, what that meant, and what that means in relation to you not being religious now, okay? That takes some restructuring. Social work, okay, which I'm going to spend a lot of time on, just meant the severing of the incompatible ties and joining more congruent social associations. I'm not going to go into that right now because I have a really awesome slide for you. Emotional work was just the deliberate shift in emotional disposition, right? Like, I can sit and feel sorry for myself. I can sit and drink myself into a stupor. Or I could do something and be productive. I can figure out what's going on. Now, doing this paradigmatic work was awesome. It's great for them, okay? Because whereas they had a lot to lose, they really had a lot to gain, right? Is there anybody in this room that doesn't think they had a lot to gain by leaving their religion, right? You don't think you had a lot to gain? No? Okay. Don't think you had a lot to gain. What did they gain, okay? A new understanding of morals and values, right? So now, no longer, you know, did you need this idea of religion to be good, right? You could be good without God, right? That's their catchphrase, good without God. Their purpose was now self-driven, right? It wasn't like your God-driven purpose, right? Or whatever it is that Rick Warren is always preaching about, right? It's a self-driven purpose, okay? I don't have to do what God's plan is for me, which is like ambiguous always at best because, you know, God's not a very good communicator, okay? I can decide what my purpose is. Existential answers. All right, so let's see. There's no God, there's no heaven, right? When I die, this is it, okay? This realization that the time here is ever so finite, okay? This is it. This is the only chance we get. That might depress some people, you know? Or it might motivate people, right? Because now, with this idea that the time we have here is very finite, comes a lot of autonomy and choice, okay? I choose who I'm going to associate. I choose the activities I'm going to participate in because I might not have tomorrow. So I'm not going to sit in like youth group or Sunday school or like in church like Wednesday night and Saturday night and Sunday morning. I'm going to go out and spend time with the people I love because I might not be here the next day. There was also an increase in tolerance and respect, right? Because being stigmatized when you're leaving, feeling rejected when you just say, hey, you know what, these beliefs don't really work for me anymore, so, you know, I'm going to try something else. Heathen! Sinner! You're going to hell. Right? Like, having that experience for many really gave them some tolerance. Like, no, I'm not going to think you're like that, right? And it really gave them an increased sense of respect. Respect for one another, respect for themselves. Again, that whole finite time. Okay, this is my question, right? Is this enough to compensate for what is lost? What do you think?
Yes.
No! No, it's not. This is all individual. Remember in the beginning, I said, what are churches great for doing? Connection. Okay, you can have all of these, but if you don't have connection, connection's the most important thing, and I'm not just saying that because I'm a sociologist. Connection is good. I'm biased. I heard that. So what's needed? Okay, what's needed? It's this social work. Okay. Deconversion can be ugly. All right. Rejection, stigmatization, alienation. Okay? There ain't nothing that's going to make that better. Like, a lot of people go through that. Okay? There's nothing that can erase that. Okay? But this can mitigate the effects. Okay? So I said social work was severing those incompatible ties. Right? Sometimes you have to sever those ties. Other times, oh, those ties are severed for you. Sorry, Elizabeth, pack your bags and go. Right? Loss of family, friends, peers. Okay? Assign negative labels. Defector, backslider, heathen, immoral. You're now immoral. Okay? You're a perfectly good person before, but now, not so much. Okay? That stigmatization, that marginalization. That's not healthy. Does anybody here think that's healthy? Okay, that's not healthy. Right, so we got to get rid of that. Get rid of that. Okay, but you need to replace it. Okay, and you do this by forming more congruent associations. Now, in 1993, there was a study that came out by some researchers that looked at the differences between religious adherents and religious apostates. And what they found, again, another quantitative study, okay, check the box. What they found was that religious adherents were significantly, statistically significantly happier, well-adjusted, had well-being, higher self-esteem, and generally, overall, just a higher level of life satisfaction than apostates. 1993, okay, why might that be? Why might that be? Community? Was there community in 1993? Okay, I was like 17, 16. It's the year before I graduated high school. Okay, I wasn't on the internet. Okay, my friends were my face-to-face interactions, or my family. Okay? So those findings are not surprising in 1993. The good news is that's not necessarily what it's like now. Okay? Because we have these virtual communities. Okay? Meetup.com. That's where Las Vegas atheists like do all of their stuff through, and the Havelstein group, like they're the humanist group in Las Vegas. Internet is great. Boards, forums, Facebook, Twitter. I don't tweet, but you know, you get it, right? You can find people that are like-minded. How important is that for validation? Yeah, right? Right? Yes. Okay. Physical communities, such as the Ex-Mormon Foundation, for example, right? And various post-Mormon groups, like the one I got the privilege of being at in St. George. Those people were great, and you guys are great too. Look around. Look at each other. Okay? Even if you don't know one another, just your presence. Do you feel it? Do you feel the energy in this room? Right? Yeah? I hope so, because I do. You guys are putting it off. Okay? You guys have a collective energy. You guys have a collective identity. You know, those of you who are ex-Mormon, post-Mormon, right? You have something in common. I might not know you. I'm pointing at you. But we're non-believers. I'm just going to guess, okay?
Yeah, no.
Okay, good. All right? I don't know your name. I don't know where you're from. I don't know your blood type. I don't know anything about you. But we have something in common, don't we?
Yes.
And we have common ground. Okay, and I can look at you and I can smile. Okay, just knowing that I have somebody at least that's like-minded, that might understand my experience. That's important. And through these physical communities, a lot of times you can find different service opportunities or social gatherings like this, right? Please tell me, when you go home, when you leave here tomorrow, are you going home feeling recharged? Are you going home feeling just awesome-tastic about your decision not to be a Mormon? Right? Right? This is important. This is not just important. This is crucial. Okay? Adam says, my friend circle became a non-theist friend circle, and that was important to me. Yeah. Validation. Okay? When you're leaving religion, that's something that's known. Right, you know what to believe, you know how to behave, you know what the norms are. You're essentially going into an unknown, right? Because there are so many choices out there, right? Spiritual, not religious, you can be agnostic, you can be a moderate atheist, you can be a militant atheist, you can be a new atheist, you can be, you know, there's so many categories, don't even get me started, right? You can be just a secularist or a humanist, right? Or just a free thinker or a bright. Okay, there's so many options. Not everybody knows what they're going to be when they leave, right? So you're going from something that's known to a very big question mark, okay? Having a group of people to help you through it. How many had people to help them through it? A few of you, okay? Was it easier having people? Those who didn't have anybody, was that a really hard experience? Difficult?
Very difficult.
Okay. Just having people to help you, finding a social group. Elizabeth said, what really helped me was that I moved across country. My immediate going from Christianity was going to a group of atheists. Hello, 180. Right? I mean, she was heading that way anyway. Now she's actually the president of the Secular Student Alliance at UNLV, so good for her. Good for her. Barclay found, I didn't put his quote up here, but he did find acceptance with his brother's group of friends, of all people. They drank a lot, so just it worked. What are you getting, though? Okay, you're not just getting validation. You're getting love, grace, hope, friendship, acceptance. It's kind of cool, huh? I did that just for you. This idea of grace. We usually think about grace in terms of a religious context, don't we? Okay, but when we think about that increased tolerance and that increased respect, there's grace there, isn't there? Right? That's important, to not feel like you're going to be judged by a bunch of immoral heathens that are hellbound. Right? It was important for my participants. I want you to think about if that's important to you. So I am here to tell you today that there is a hopeful future. Yes, there is. Can I get an amen? Amen. Or a ramen if you're a spaghetti person.
Holy Jesus.
Love it. What the empirical findings of my study suggest is that overall, deconversion is a net positive. However, the initial transition required a much higher cost than expected return. This is really speaking to this thing in sociology and in religious studies called the religious economies model. Okay, America is described as a spiritual marketplace, right? There's so many different denominations, so many things that you can choose from. Well, the religious economies scholars, they thought that they would be clever and just take an economic model, an economic theory, and transpose it onto religion, right? So what they are proposing is that people interact within the spiritual marketplace the same way they would interact in any kind of market. Right, when you're thinking about purchasing something, kind of a cost-benefit analysis, like, do I really need this? Is it on sale? Like, what am I going to get for it? For how much is it going to cost? And they make the argument that that's how people approach religion. Well, maybe, okay, but that's not how my participants approached leaving religion, okay, because the cost was high, and although it ended up being a net positive, they were not aware of that, and they were still willing to pay that price. The key factor, okay, if I've not driven it home yet, I'm going to now. The key factor for deconversion being a happy experience is the immediate access to a supportive, non-religious social circle. Again, acceptance, friendship, love, grace, validation. So you should be happy. Even though America is a spiritual marketplace, non-belief, I believe, I argue, has emerged as an option, right? We do have a secular culture. All of my participants' narratives together form a discourse of deconversion, right? You can take this with you when you go, and if you know somebody that's coming out that wants to leave, guess what? You've got a tool now. Hey, I listened to this chick in this meeting I was at. This is exactly what she studied. This is how her people did it. Why don't you try this? I've just armed you. Don't say I never gave you anything. Right? Okay? Non-belief has emerged as a viable and available option in the spiritual marketplace. Okay? The discourse of deconversion is a cultural tool that you all can use. Okay? For yourselves, maybe some of you haven't left and are thinking about it. Okay, maybe some of you are not thinking about it. That's fine too. Okay, we don't judge. Maybe you know someone that's leaving or wants to leave or doesn't know how to leave. Okay, use us. Let me end their stories for you, because I bet you have some questions, huh? I'm gonna mute this real quick. When you're a researcher, sometimes there's a moment when you're conducting an interview, right? And you've got to listen carefully because sometimes you need to ask questions a different way and we try and trick you, right? Because you're not giving us the answer we want. I'm just letting out trade secrets now. But sometimes there's a moment that is gold. And my research was really going in a different direction until I sat down to have lunch with Adam. And he said the following thing, which I'm going to read to you. And I just knew. I just knew I had gold. And I'm so thankful that I was able to run with this. He says, I feel like I won the cosmic lottery just by being here. Thank you. Can you say that again? And that doesn't mean I can't get upset when things go wrong. It doesn't mean I can't get hurt when people do things that violate trust or just disappoint me. But it does mean that when I look at my relationships as a whole, I just say I'm fortunate that I have any of this at all, let alone how far I am from feeling like there is some element of me that deserves something better than the life I have. I just feel so fortunate that I am here and that I have any level of happy relationships and meaning in life, and that's amazing to me. It's a depth of new experience that I wasn't aware of, that I wasn't aware that was there when I believed in God.
Will you leave that up for just a second?
Yes. Anybody get goosebumps? Because I did, and I deal with this data all the time. I'd be happy to make this available if there's a way that Sue can get this all to you. That's absolutely fine. Yeah, I'd be happy to make this available to you. Elizabeth, remember I told you, she moved cross-country to go move in with her internet boyfriend and his group of atheists. Honestly, you guys, this is one of the best descriptions I have ever heard. She says, I told my mom a while ago that the best analogy I could come up with is that I felt like I was born to run marathons. I felt like I was born to run like the wind, and every time I would start running, somebody would bash me in the kneecaps. Owie. I would heal and get back up, and somebody would bash me in the kneecaps again. Okay, double owie. That somebody was religion. And I finally got rid of religion, and now I can run. I can run free and unimpeded. I'm happy because I'm living the way I was born. More chill bumps. Barkley, my poor alcoholic friend Barkley. No, Barkley's great. He's phenomenal, phenomenal human being. He says, remember, he had a lot to lose, right? Self-worth, acceptance, always being compared to his brother, even though he was a great kid. But he says, I couldn't have chosen a better path. It literally sent me down a path where I am no longer compared to anyone. I found something that I can greatly excel at. It's a home in and of itself. And it sort of inspired a worth of life in the end. You have a very, very finite time, and you have to enjoy every fucking second of it. Otherwise, what the hell else are we here for? What the hell else are we here for? Let me give you my concluding thoughts. The visibility and availability of groups like the Ex-Mormon Foundation are crucial for contributing to a happy, liberating, and satisfying ex-Mormon, post-Mormon experience. And all secular experience. These are just some of the logos from secular groups that are out there on the internet that could help you. And no, they're not all atheist, right? But they're there. They're there for you. They're a resource, so use them. Use them. This is just some resources for you guys. I'm sure you're probably familiar with all of these. And thank you so much for letting me talk with you today.
Great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to add one thing. Recently, there was a survey of the religious landscape that came out, and for the first time in America, thanks to the 1 out of 5 Americans who now identify themselves with none of the above.
The spiritual nuns.
That's spiritual nuns. Protestants are no longer a majority in this country. For the first time, the religious nuns make up the second largest religious identification after Catholicism in this country. And they have also become a powerful political asset to the Democrats, just as powerful as the evangelical right is to the conservatives. So, way to go, nuns.
And that's my dissertation, the secular movement. Yes.
And the fastest growing religious identification over the past 10 years.
And the millennials, too. Like, the millennials are really contributing to that because of the millennials. I think it was something like 50 or 60% of millennials would vote for an atheist president. Okay, considering national religion, civil religion, like I pledge allegiance to that imaginary God, that's amazing.
As you know, the one big difference, one of the many differences with Mormonism compared to evangelical Christianity is that this Mormonism is an actual recognized subculture. And so that creates an entirely separate bubble that people have to deal with when they leave Mormonism that just doesn't exist. We also go from Mormonism, and some of us land in Christianity first. We have to go from Christianity to agnosticism or atheism. Could you comment on that?
Actually, the evangelicals are a recognized subculture as well. They take on, this is Christian Smith wrote an amazing book called American Evangelicalism, Embattled and Thriving, wanting to understand why in the face of pluralism, like, this one religion was, like, growing more than any of the other religions. And what he finds is that the evangelicals intentionally take on this subcultural identity, being the embattled minority, saying that everybody's against me. I'm in my Christian land, but it's not a Christian land anymore. Just so they can create conflict and tension and threats, which is what they need to thrive. So have you guys heard of the culture wars? Right? So you've got the progressives, like, you know, non-religious. You've got the religious right. Like, they're a large part of that. I wasn't aware that Mormons were considered a subculture. No. Really? Talk with me after.
One quick comment.
Yeah.
Some of the oddity that you hear written about Mitt Romney is, mm-hmm. is his participation as an elite in this subculture that makes him identifiably dissimilar to the great American culture.
Right.
I think something that could be addressed with the social work for a Mormon would be a reevaluation of rituals. Mm-hmm. There's so many rituals in Mormonism that you just do at different ages and along different gender lines, stuff like that. Where do you see that in your research or future research?
Yeah, well, and here's the great thing about pop culture and the fact that I just wrote an 8-hour exam on this very topic yesterday. Rituals, part of culture, right? Rituals and symbols are a cultural element. They're a cultural tool, right? So just because you leave Mormonism doesn't mean you leave behind important rituals, right? Rituals are redefined, okay? Symbols become redefined. Now, they're present in pop culture, okay? Religious symbolism is everywhere in pop culture. But think about baseball for a second, if you will. My advisor actually did his dissertation research on Fenway Park, right? And lucky while he was there, lucky for him, the Red Sox broke the curse of the Bambino and actually won a World Series. But while he was there, he kind of like observed this religion of baseball, like this religion of Red Sox Nation, this singing Sweet Caroline at every single game, or, you know, spending $2 to buy the program before every single game, or going to the bar, right, or wearing the gear, right? These all become ritualized acts, right? In pop culture, it becomes almost like a secular religion, if you will, right? So when you leave Mormonism, or any religion for that fact, okay, you're not necessarily losing symbolic culture, ritual culture, okay? Because there's so many more things out there that you can replace it with. Does that address your question? Yeah, everything changes. But when you get involved with new social groups, guess what? You create new culture, you create new symbolic meanings, and yes, you create new rituals.
Okay, last one. Okay, so hi.
Hi.
I actually live in Las Vegas, so this is like totally
Yay.
Cool that you're here. Yay!
Yay!
So I know that you've just like met all of us in this whole Mormon craziness thing, or ex-Mormon crazy thing. Anyway, you've done a lot of work with evangelical
yeah.
Christians and whatnot. Have you done any work with any Scientology
no.
people getting out this?
No.
Do you want to?
Maybe once I get tenure. I don't know what's worse, like the Scientologist or the atheist? I'm not sure. And I say this about all religions across the board, so I do not mean to offend anybody, but I want to find out about the beliefs getting in conversion to, deconversion out of all of the batshit crazy religions. All of them, right? my own. And so maybe one day I will do Scientology. I wonder what my access will be like. Like, I could pass as an evangelical, you know, so I could get back in there if I needed to. Or, you know, I have enough Mormon friends, I could probably pass as a Mormon, okay? I don't have to drink the caffeine, and, you know, I'm down with populating a planet. That's really all I know. I know, it's terrible. But it's getting access as a researcher, too. You have to be really flexible to try and get in places. But yes, maybe one day. Thank you so much.